It's now 8 o'clock and time for another talk. And this is second or third day. Hopefully that everybody is settled in and you get some idea of the meditation. And you also, many of you have come here, you've been here many times or been on other retreats, so you have a reasonable idea of how to meditate. But also today it's a time just to do a talk which I always give in all of my retreats, and it's the simile of the thousand-petal lotus, which elaborates on what meditation is, how to meditate, what happens, why it happens. It's the best simile which I could ever come up with. And as you see, lotuses are just such a part of Buddhism. Even over here, we've got a couple of lotuses over there. They're all plastic lotuses, which are great. So they don't need any water. They just like that all the time. Isn't it beautiful? But with lotus flowers, they're part of Buddhism. They have many, many similes of lotuses. And some of those similes I'll just do first of all because I really think they're important. And one of those similes is that a lotus, the petals, they never keep anything. Whatever pours on them just flows off almost immediately. And so we always use that if anybody criticizes you and says bad words about you, puts you down, scolds you, we always think of that as like somebody urinating on a lotus. And if you urinate on a lotus, all of the urine just drips off it. It falls off. So afterwards, the lotus has no smell of the urine. It's all gone. It doesn't keep anything. And then somebody goes past and they pour Chanel number 5 over the lotus. That's like somebody praising you. And still, it just all drips off and it keeps absolutely nothing. Nothing of the smell of the perfume. It still smells like a lotus. And that's one of those similes I really like, because sometimes in my position, sometimes people really praise me and sometimes people really criticize me. And so what happens? I just remember I'm just like a lotus and it all drips off. So afterwards, it leaves nothing at all. That's a wonderful way to look at a lotus. And if you don't sort of, but don't test that. You can test it out for yourself. Don't try it on me. Don't urinate on me and then get out some perfume and pour it on me and see if it sticks. You can try it on yourself if you like. But the whole point is that nothing stays. As soon as it hits it, then it disappears. And just like before I came in here, just sitting for a few minutes and got a bit hot over by the stupa, I just felt the beautiful breeze. It was a very light breeze this morning. Kept me a bit cool. And you never know where the breeze comes from. You never know where it goes after it passes you. All you ever know is what's happening right now, this momentary awareness. And you can't trace it back. The wind has like got no past. I don't know where it's come from. And you just feel it as it's happening right now. And then it goes. Who knows where it goes? I don't go chasing or following the wind. You just appreciate it when it's right here, right now. And you can't bottle it. You can't photograph it. You can't capture it. When it's here, you enjoy it. And then you let it go. So, those are beautiful little similes of what this meditation is all about. The sort of attitudes which help the meditation get so peaceful and so still and so beautiful. So, but the general thing is people say, well, how do you meditate? What am I supposed to do? And they say, well, just sit here and do nothing. Yeah, but how do I do nothing? Nothing is what happens when you're not doing things. So you can't do nothing. You have to let go of doing and then nothing is there. But that is still a bit tough for many people to get their heads around. So we have this gradual way of letting go. And it's called the simile of the thousand-petal lotus. And it starts off understanding that the lotus flowers, the real ones, not the plastic ones, the real ones close up at night. And I'm sure you've seen closed-up lotus flowers, just a little like cone. And have a look at one if you next time you find one. Have a look at it. On the outside, that outside layer of petals, that has to endure the wind and the storms and the rain and anything else which hits it. That's the protective outer layer. So the protective outer layer of the lotus flower is always really thick. It is not coloured at all, and it is not beautiful. It's usually like almost corrugated, and it has no fragrance to it. You put your nose close enough to it, you can't smell anything. And all it means is that's the outermost covering, which is closed up at night time. And what happens in the early morning, the sun rises, and it is the light and warmth of the sun which opens the lotus up. Those two qualities of sunlight, its light and its warmth. And when that hits the outermost sheath of the lotus, I won't even call it a petal, it's like a sheath, then that starts to open up, and you've seen lotuses as they open. And inside that layer of petals, or that sheath, is the first real layer of petals. You can see some colours in them. And maybe not much fragrance yet, but there is still a scent of the lotus there. And that allows that first real layer of petals to receive the light and the warmth of the sun. And you've probably figured out that I'm focusing on these two qualities, the light and the warmth, because these two qualities represent mindfulness, that's light, and kindness, the warmth. That's what opens the lotus, and that's what opens you. So the warmth and light of the sun gets onto the next layer of petals, and they open up. And as you go deeper into the lotus, as the lotus opens more and more, it becomes more beautiful. The inner petals of the lotus are far more attractive than maybe the first or second layer. And they're thinner, they are more profound, more subtle, and they are far more fragrant, they're more beautiful. As you go deeper and deeper into the lotus, the beauty and the fragrance increases. And you go right inside, warmth and the light of the sun open up the outer petal, and it reveals what's inside. And what's inside of that opens up to reveal what's inside of that. That's how the lotus opens up. And sometimes when you start, you think there can't be anything much inside this dirty, shaggy, destroyed, damaged, you know, lotus bud, a lotus flower, which sometimes you can see in a lake or in a pond somewhere. You think nothing can be interesting inside of this. But you know, in every lotus, if you can open it up, the most beautiful fragrant of petals. And that is where, inside each one of you, little lotuses, if you can open it up, it's amazing what you'll find inside. And that's one of the first wonderful parts of that simile, is it means each one of you, and I'm not saying this lightly, each one of you has these beautiful deep meditations right in the heart of you. Trouble is getting to there. Opening up your body, your mind enough to start to see what's inside. And the example I always give about this was about 3 or 4 years ago, this gentleman came to one of these retreats here, a 9-day retreat. And when this gentleman turned up, he was an Australian fellow, and he's a local, somewhere in Perth. When he turned up, he was dressed in traditional Australian dress. Dirty t-shirt, shorts and thongs. And he had tattoos all over him. And he was big. He really looked like a very rough person. And being a stupid monk, sometimes I really get it wrong. And when I do get it wrong, I never hide my mistakes. I like telling people because they're funny. At least I think it's funny. Anyway, as soon as I saw him, you may know that just 6 kilometers down the road from here, if you go out the gate and you turn left instead of right to monastery, and you keep going for 6 kilometers, there is a prison. It's an open prison. They're nice prisoners up there. They only just do a small amount of murders and rapes. And it's a long way away, so you don't have to worry about anything. Although once, what was it? That's right, we were doing a retreat here quite a few years ago now. And that's right, the person who was supposed to do the cooking, they got sick. And Bianca wasn't available. Oh, what am I going to do? A retreat was happening and just an emergency. So one of the prisoners, he said, I'll do it. So we got permission from the prison authorities. And he came, a day release from up the road, and cooked every day for the retreatants. And he was an amazing cook. He was so energetic. I must admit, you may not think this is possible, but he actually worked harder than Bianca does. It was incredible to watch him. He would make pizzas. He'd make the whole thing, from the bread. And from the flour, and make all the sort of basics and get all the stuff and do everything. And he was just such a happy fellow. And then, I never told people, I said, who is that? It's amazing. Can you come to our retreat? Because, they wanted to organize a retreat. Can he be the cook? No, he's still got a few years to go yet. And because we knew him, he's a really nice fellow, it was for violent rape. And I didn't tell people until the last day. He made a couple of big mistakes when he was young and had to pay for it for many years, but totally reformed, a very nice guy. But anyway, so the prison just up the road. And so I said to him, excuse me, sir, I think you got the wrong place. This is the meditation retreat. This guy who was just all tattooed. And said, the prison is up the road there, 6 kilometres. Just get out the gate, turn left, and you'll soon get there to see your friends. Or something like that. I really put my foot in it sometimes, actually more often than I admit. But so he said, no, I'm on the retreat. He gave me his name and had some idea. And I thought, oh, yeah, you are indeed. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. And my parents is to tell everybody about that. But the reason I had to tell about that particular case was in that retreat, after 4 or 5 days, he came for the interviews and he said how his meditation was going. And wow! I mean, he really got into it. And, it's not often I tell people, yeah, okay, that was a jhana, well done. And I told him, yeah, you got into one of the really deep meditations. And to me, it was like, I'm still almost like shocked at how I could judge a person like that, but how he could follow the instructions, and a person just goes deep, 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 and gets into these really blissful states. And well done, that gentleman. So, in each one of you, the outermost petals of the lotus, that sheath can be all dirty, it can be tattooed or whatever, and that doesn't really mean anything at all. You may be old, you may be young, you may be really sick, you may have not done any meditation before. It doesn't matter. In every human being, if you open it up enough, you find these incredible, beautiful, delightful states of mind in each one of you. So the point is that it's there. How do you open up? And that is with, again, the warmth and light, the kindness and the mindfulness. The two have to go together. If there's not enough kindness, there's not enough joy, there's nothing which really can really open things out. Just being mindful, being aware all the time, it's just like some sort of professor or some robot gathering data, like a private investigator of your mind, trying to find out what's going on by really being vigilant. It has to be kind as well. And that's a really important part of the meditation. So what do you do? You have, first of all, the outermost petal of your lotus is your body, with all the tattoos and the age and the gender specifications and the racial specifications and the health and the height, whatever, all that sort of rubbish. That's on the outside. So you've got to open that out and see what's on the inside of you. And I don't mean by getting a knife and just giving yourself a... Because people have all this, it's so physical, so material, to the point that, you know that first book which I wrote, Opening the Door of Your Heart? There was some people over in Adelaide. They went to the big bookshop there looking for it. And they went into the... Okay, let's do it properly. They went to the counter there, and can you please tell me where the section on self-help books is? And the person on the counter said, you've got to find it for yourself, because if I told you, it would spoil the purpose. Self-help books. So anyway, so they, because they went to that self-help help section, religious section, they couldn't find it anywhere there. It's not there. And so they went on the computer, you know, which they do these days, and they found out, yeah, it was in the store, but it was in the medical section on cardiology. You guess it. True story in Adelaide. So, somebody looked at the title, Open the Door of Your Heart. Must be heart surgeon. And that's where they put it. But it's not material. There's something deeper than this. So to actually to open ourselves up, not with a knife, but with this mindfulness and kindness. You sit down or you walk, you lay down, you really get to know your body, and you're kind to it. You're aware and kind. So the first few days, always encourage a lot of kindness, a lot of awareness. And even with Bianca, you know, just to tell her, look, you know, if you want to give a special breakfast or lunch for people, please do so. Forget about the money, because we're here to just serve, not to make profits. This is Buddhism is only one of the very few non-profit religions. We don't have prophets, like Jesus was a prophet, Muhammad was a prophet. We don't have any of those. So anyway, instead, look after people. Not indulging, but be kind. And when you are kind, number one, you can hopefully you feel this by now, that you don't feel afraid in this meditation retreat center. You're not just watching your back all the time. Is someone going to hit me? Is Ajahn Brahm going to tell me off? Am I going to get into trouble for something? A lot of times people are just so afraid because you have gone into trouble for things from the past. People say, you're not sitting right. You've got to do it this way. Don't do it that way. You're too late. You're too early. You make too much noise. And whatever you do, you're always doing something wrong. That is not the way to train the body. Kindness. When you're really kind, you relax. When you relax, you don't do anything wrong. It's really weird. I found that out a long time ago, like looking after Bodhinyana Monastery. You realize the best way to get people to keep all their precepts and rules and even do more than that, be really, really good monks, is to keep forgiving them when they make mistakes. And to make a point of saying that in Bodhinyana Monastery, that monks, novices, anagarikas are allowed to make mistakes. You don't get into trouble. Well, not too much trouble. And if you do something wrong, we usually laugh. And what was it a few years ago that somebody brought some fish and chips to the monastery. And I saw the fish, I couldn't find the chips. Where were they? So it's really weird that people actually offer fish without the chips. You know, so we couldn't find them. Okay, never mind, just let it go. And they found because there was not enough space on the table, they put it actually underneath the table. And we didn't find out until after 12 o'clock when we couldn't eat anything anymore. Oh, that was so much suffering. You may not appreciate how much suffering that is for Western monk. But did I get upset and angry? Of course not. I thought that was such a funny story. So instead of, but it's never happened again. Because now if I see some fish and there's not any chips, I always look under the table just in case. Now you can see the sort of the happiness, the joy. People make mistakes. It's not the end of the world. And we just make a joke about it and then it never happens again. That's a far more emotionally intelligent way to run a monastery than by telling people off and giving them punishments or penances. Oh, what was that case with that Anagarika once? He came up to me one morning, this was quite a few years ago. He came up to me and he said he hadn't slept all night. He was an Australian, I think from Sydney, or could be Melbourne. And he said he hadn't slept all night. And I said, why? And he said, oh, I broke my precepts last evening. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. And he said, what did you do? Who did you kill? I didn't kill anybody. Well, what did he do? He said, I was hungry. And I went to the kitchen in Bodhinyana Monastery and there was some bread there. I made myself a sandwich and put some tuna or lettuce, I don't know what he put on it. And I ate it. I broke my precepts. Of course, you can understand my response. It was wonderful. Number one, you admitted your mistakes. Excellent. Well done. And number two, look, in the eat more at lunchtime. There's plenty to eat there at lunchtime. Have a bit more sort of rice or bread or potatoes or pasta, whatever's there. You know, put some more in your tummy so it lasts a bit longer. And if you do get hungry in the afternoon or the evening, there's so many what we call these allowables you can eat. And you can see what's on your table. If you don't know, like what's on the table over here, just go over to Bodhinyana Monastery. There's other things over there. There's chocolate and there's cheese and there's honey and there's juices. And I don't know what you have over here, but it's enough to feed an army over at Bodhinyana Monastery. So he said, have some of those instead. And I said, okay, now you can go now. And that's when he looked at me and he said, what? You're not going to give me a penance or a punishment? I said, no, we don't do that. He said, I have to be punished. He said, if you don't give me some penance or punishment, I'll do it again. Because I know that's my character. So he put me in a very difficult spot. Because we don't really do punishments in Buddhist monasteries. But I had to find one to give to him. So I thought very quickly and the solution came up. Of course, you know, there's many stories like this. I've been 36 years as abbot that morning. No, 20 years, 22 or something years. No, 25 years, I think now. But anyway, a long time. So I've had lots and lots of examples. Sometimes when I give solutions, they're the wrong solutions, but I don't tell you those stories. I only tell you the stories when it works out. So I was told him, said, that morning I'd been reading this book by John Hughes. Is John Hughes the author? And it was about the early history of Australia. I said, I've just been reading it that morning as it happened. And I said, well, okay, if you want a punishment, an Australian punishment, I've just been reading about the early history of what the people did to the convicts in Australia. If they did anything wrong, they would be flogged with this really gruesome, this torturous instrument called the cat of nine tails. Said, okay, you want a punishment? I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. And this guy, he not only went more quiet than you did, but you know, he was wearing white clothes, but his face went whiter than the jacket he was wearing. He really, really thought that I was going to whip him. That's how little he knew about Buddhism. And then then I let him just suffer for a little bit. I'm not there. That was his real punishment, just being afraid for a few minutes. And I said, and 50 strokes of the cat if you want a punishment. And what that means here is at that time we had two cats in the monastery. Find either one of them and give them 50 strokes. One, two, three, four. That was called the punishment of 50 strokes of the cat. in a Buddhist monastery. We don't have any cats here now, but we do have teddy bears. So if any of you break any of your rules, take one of the teddy bears, 50 strokes for the first offence. One, two, one. Where's my toes? Little teddy bear over there. In other words, learn some compassion, some kindness. That is how you mend mistakes, through kindness, awareness and kindness. Bring it up, let people know, and be kind. It's only a mistake, that's all, it's not a big deal. And be kind to yourself, and then you find you don't do it again. But people who just want punishment, they keep doing it again and again and again. So that's the way the mindfulness and kindness, that's what opens you up. You actually start to feel, ha-ha, good about yourself. I already got that question yesterday, and it was shared by many people. I don't feel I'm good enough. I think I'm terrible. I don't think... Oh, come on, give yourself a break. You're more than good enough to get really incredible deep meditation. Who was that gentleman, the serial killer in Buddhism? Yes. What happened to him? He got enlightened. So a serial killer could get enlightened. What about you? How many serial killers have we got in this retreat? So the message from that story is that even a serial killer could get so deep in their meditation, could really open up, see what's inside, even they can get enlightened. Crazy, mad? Oh, you know, sometimes people say, oh, you've just got to be psychologically balanced before you can meditate, or especially get enlightened. And there was. Who was the crazy lady who came to see the Buddha with no clothes on? Yes, Patachara. Anyway, she's actually one of my heroes, and I'll tell you why afterwards. That, you know, she ran away with her lover because they wasn't accepted by her family. They got married, had two kids, and decided that with two children, you know what it's like. I know enough about this. Even though I'd never been married, I give lots of marriage counselling. Weird, isn't it? Why is it when people get married, they always want somebody who's never been married to do the ceremony for them? Anyway, so off she went to once she had kids, she thought, oh, having kids, their parents will probably be okay with them and accept their marriage. So off she went with her kids, and on the way to the where her parents lived, she was pregnant with the second kid. Oh no, she'd just given birth. And on the way, it was a cold evening, storm was coming up. So her husband went off to collect some wood to make a fire for his wife and two little babies. And there was a snake in the wood. And the snake bit the husband, and Patachara's husband, bitten, died. She lost her husband. Ah! So she got up and just tried to make it to where her parents were, but it was a big storm. The river was flooded, so she didn't know how to get across. They couldn't wade across. So what she did... She told her oldest son just to stay, and on one side, and she carried her youngest across, and she put the youngest safely. It was very tough, a very strong current. Put the kid down on, and then waded back to pick up the older kid. And halfway in the middle of the river, she heard a big sound, and she saw there was an eagle had picked up the younger kid, the little baby. And so she turned around and shouted, "Yeah, yeah, yeah!" And the older kid thought, "Oh, she's calling me across." And so, with the eagle taking away the younger kid, the older kid waded into the water. It was far too strong a current, far too deep for him. Got swept down, swept away to his death. So in that incident, she lost her two children. And when she managed to get to the dry part of, to wade back again. And she thought, oh, I really have to see my parents now. And when she got a little bit closer, she met somebody and said, oh, I'm going to see my, my parents, who are they? They said, oh, they're not too late. Last night in the storm, a big tree fell in their house. They're both killed. And in 24 hours, she'd lost her husband, her two children, her mother and her father. Wow. So she went crazy. She just couldn't take the grief. And she went totally mad. And she was wandering around, just not knowing where she was or what she was doing. And then, good karma, I suppose, she wandered into the Jetavana monastery, where the Buddha was. And he was giving a sermon. And then this naked lady, you know, young woman, that just had given birth. And so young woman, no clothes on, and people shouted, get out of here, get out of here. And the Buddha took one look at her and said, come in. I like that story because the Buddha had this incredible compassion and kindness. Everyone else, crazy lady, no clothes on, get out of here. He said, no, you come in. And one of the monks, you know, just took off a spare robe and put it around her to make her look decent. And the Buddha gave her a little teaching. And eventually she became a bhikkhuni, became fully enlightened, and became this amazing teacher. And the reason I got impressed with her, because there is these wonderful books about, they call it Theragata and Terigata. Theragata is the verses of the enlightened monks. And Terigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns from the time of the Buddha. And she's in there, obviously, her story. But there's also all these other stories of this nun. She'd been meditating for years and nothing was happening. And then she came across this great teacher who taught her how to meditate properly. And she got enlightened within days. And this other bhikkhuni. And then this wonderful teacher came along and taught me how to meditate. And I came enlightened within a few days. So many bhikkhunis. They listened to this Patachara. Because that was that bhikkhuni. And became enlightened. She was the greatest teacher of those bhikkhuni, in that bhikkhuni sangha at the time. Where did that come from? That came from that little anecdote which I often give you. Tread in the dog shit. Don't scrape it off. Take it home. Dig it under the mango tree. It's fertilizer. And your mangoes are more sweet than other people's. Trouble, suffering in your life, and you've all had lots of suffering in your life. Welcome it. Don't look for it, it'll come by itself. But when it happens, welcome it. There's so much to learn, so much to grow, so much wisdom and compassion comes from the suffering of life. So, Patachara, so much suffering, and that made her an incredible teacher. Angulimala, so much suffering, that made him enlightened. So, each one of you has had a lot of suffering in your life, which means you've got everything you need to become enlightened. Those who suffered more, oh, you're at the front. If you only know how to make use of it. So how do you make use of it? You're mindful, you're kind. We're talking about that gentleman who had the Anagarika, who keeping eight precepts but had a sandwich at night time. Awareness, mindfulness, means bringing it up, getting to know it, seeing it clearly. By telling someone else, you're telling yourself and you see it very clearly. And the kindness for me, just forgiving it. Those two open a person up. So, in your life, first of all, your body. Oh, it's got an ache here, a pain there, I'm getting old, getting tired, wearing out. That's just part of life, but it's good enough. So you look at your body, you're kind to it. Find the best posture for it. Even leaning back, and I don't mind about that because I know enough about meditation. If you're too hot, don't do a Patachara on me, please. Then go to some place where it's cooler. Or just, you know, get a wet cloth and put it over your head or put the aircon on. We've got an aircon here. It's a lot of money for that aircon, so we shouldn't actually make use of it. So if it gets too, is it too hot in the afternoon? Okay, aircon this afternoon. Tell Christina she can put the aircon on. And just keep yourself nice and cool, just the right temperature. If it's too cold, You get a blanket out. You know, I came from a cold country, you know, made in England. It's really cold there. I love it. So that's why sometimes when I'm really sweaty and I see people that got the blankets on them, I say, oh, crikey, where did you get born? So find a nice place. Be kind to your body. Once you're kind to your body and it gets relaxed, of course, you can't get it perfect. It's good enough. And then when it's perfect, it's got energy. And when your body has energy, it's so easy just to cross your eyes, close your eyes, and you experience, be mindful of your body and be kind to it. And you can do all those little tricks like the, you know, when you've got a stomach cramps, or you've got some other ache or pain or something here, you be so kind to it, you can actually just relax it. People actually feel better if someone comes to visit you and are kind to you. This gentleman, he was having this back operation years and years and years ago. I went to see him, and he was going to have an operation. He was really scared. I just put my hand on his shoulder and said, it'll be okay. And he said that was one of the most important things he'd ever experienced in his life. You know, his teacher was just kind, just put my hand on his shoulder and just said, it'll be okay. It gave him some kindness. And that just really went straight into him, deep into him, and he said it really made a huge difference. Little acts of kindness are very powerful. So how about your own little acts of kindness to your own body? An ache here, a headache, tired, itchy. Just be kind to your body. Give it a scratch. And then you find the body relaxes. When the body relaxes, it's not a problem anymore. You can sit here, body okay? Yep. And then when you're kind and mindful to your body, it relaxes. So what happens? You get that delight coming up. That's almost like the body saying, thank you. And then you go inside to the mind. So now you've gone inside the cover, which is your body, into the mind. What's the first thing you noticed in the mind? It is the first thing which I always ask people to look at is like time. Because we're all prisoners of the past and the future. I don't know why you are, because the past has no relevance at all. We said that we're made of the past. Exactly. You make this big sense of self, of who you are, and what you can do and what you can't do. And if you believe that, you actually become your past. I saw this when I was a school teacher. And it was, maybe it wasn't fair. I maybe agree it was unfair. I shouldn't have done this, but I did. One of the kids was bottom in my maths class the year before. And so I decided to see, was that because, if a person comes bottom, was that because they can't do maths? Or is there some other reason? And so I decided for 1 year, as his maths teacher, to give him extra attention. You know, when you're given a problem on the board and the students, so about 13 or 14 year olds, when they were doing the tests, I would go to his desk and say, do you understand that? And no, sir. I said, oh, do it this way, that way. Oh, that way. Okay, yeah, well done. I gave him this extra special attention. After the class, did you understand that, Paul? He said, oh, yeah, yeah, thank you so much. And because I gave him extra attention, I was denying other kids that attention. You only got a certain amount of time. But, of course, you know what happened? At the end of that year, he wasn't bottom. He was top. He came top of the maths class simply because he had a teacher who gave him that bit extra and encouraged him. And that really sort of, that shook me that you could actually do that. It's not a person can't do maths. It's not they can't do geography. It's not they can't do sport. They just need encouragement. So, when you encouraged him, he came top. And I always remember that when I became a teacher of people meditating. I was like, oh, I can't meditate. You reckon? Of course you can. That's part, you're a human being. That's part of being a human being, have a mind. And if you know how to make use of it, it's amazing what you can do. So let go of that past. Don't be a prisoner of the past. Because last year you couldn't meditate, doesn't mean today you can't become enlightened. So when you start imprisoning yourself in your past failures especially, then you're free. So, you let go of the past and the future. What's going to happen in the future? Some people are just so negative. I'm happy that I told that old story about the two bad bricks in the wall. What is fear and anxiety? It is just looking at the future. As you looked at the two bad bricks in the wall, ooh, it's going to go wrong, woo. We're all going to die. Woo. No, you're not. At least not on my retreat. I guarantee that. Otherwise, you can get your money back. You don't need it back anyway. That time. How long have we been? This is the 11th year we've been teaching here. No one, not one person has died on these meditation retreats. Not one. Okay? So we're not going to start now. So you're perfectly safe. Now, if you worry about all the bad things which are going to happen in the future, have you ever noticed that you bring around about those bad things, they tend to happen? The more you worry about them, it's almost like it's wish fulfillment. But if you don't worry about things, then nothing bad happens. It's almost like a karmic teaching there. So, don't worry about bad things. Worry about good things. No, you don't worry at all, actually. It's much better. So the past is just, you know, you can imprison yourself by the past. The future, again, you can imprison yourself with the future as well. Instead, now, this moment is where your future is being made. You're actually making the future right now. So what type of future are you making? I know what type of future I'm making. For me and for you too. A beautiful future, because the present is peaceful and kind and wonderful. So, we go into time. The time petals open up. We're in the present moment. We're here. This is a beautiful meditation retreat center. People come here and say, it's not a retreat center, it's a resort. If people from Singapore told me when they first came here, all we need is a golf course. And then it will be a resort. But it's simple, but it's pleasant, and it's beautiful, and it's so peaceful. It's this morning, just getting up and walking slowly here. It's so quiet here. And so that is better than a golf course. It's a peace course. And so you really appreciate just this place, and you're here. So enjoy every moment of being here. The present moment, once it's joyful, once it's delightful, of course you want to be here. I talk way too much. You know that we're starting a new therapy center. It's you know that they have things like for people who've got drug addicts and alcohol addictions. They call that. I know that one. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. But this one, the one I'm going to start, is called for people who talk too much. They're on and on anonymous. So if anyone else wants to join On and On Anonymous, I think I'll be the first founding member. Always talk too long. But anyway, so that's where you get into the present moment. And it's so peaceful there. You're aware of your mind and you're kind to it. And if you're kind to the mind just doesn't need to defend itself. It just becomes peaceful. It just enjoys this moment. Give it time. Don't force it. And you'll find there's so many moments here, you're just here. You're not expecting anything, you're not planning anything. You're just enjoying just sitting, having your lunch, looking through the window, seeing the birds fly through the sky, see the sun just beat down upon the trees, See the trees just wave in the wind. See all these people rushing this way and that way, trying to make money for something. And you're not rushing around at all. You're just sitting here, having your lunch. Peaceful. No rush. No appointments. No deadlines. No work which you need to do. Just being here. No husband. No wife. No kids. No boss. Just yourself, just being here. There comes times, I hope, for you. You sit having your lunch or having a cup of tea and you think, I don't want to go anywhere else in the whole world. I'm just going to stay here. You ever had that feeling? It's wonderful, it's just contentment. This is great, who needs anything? And now you're in the present moment, you're really enjoying it. And in the present moment, this is the next layer of petals, you're in the present moment. The next layer of petals is like a deepening of the present moment. It's right inside the present moment. And that is called silence. This moment is just so gorgeous. You can't put a name to it. Whatever name you put onto it is nowhere near good enough. You know, it took me years. If I ever find this teacher, I think, well, they're probably dead now anyway, to pursue them. I remember just when I was in primary school, that sometimes the teacher would say, oh, what do you think about that? I said, nothing. And I got into trouble for that. Instead, they should have said, wow, you think nothing about that? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And give me a sort of a star, merit point or something. Because in our education system, we're always encouraged to think and give things names and see if we can improve our vocabulary. Whereas in meditation, we've got way too much vocabulary. We need to be quiet more and feel more and receive information. It's a simile which I got up, was like the world is Dharma, it's trying to teach us stuff. It's like the universe is talking to us, like life is talking to us. Your cushion is talking to you. How do you feel? The weather is talking to you. Are you too warm or too cold? But we're so busy talking to ourselves, called thinking, we're not listening to life. I think the first time this really came up to me was when I read a book, I think it was in Thailand, about people who had heart attacks. And they said, heart attacks don't come out of the blue. Your body gives you warning after warning after warning after warning after warning. But you're too busy thinking about something else, planning something, worrying about something, or looking at some stupid soap opera on the TV to really feel what's going on in your body and to get to know your body. It's teaching you, telling you so much. That is one of the reasons, believe it or not, one of the healthiest monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery. I very, very, very rarely get sick. And sometimes why? It's not my diet. That doesn't explain it. That almost confounds the fact you can be sort of reasonably healthy. Why? And a lot of times it's because I am aware of my body. And my body can sometimes feel it, oh, something's wrong there. There's some sort of tightness or tension. It's not just of big food poisoning, there's other stuff as well that sometimes you feel, You know, one of the things which I do, if you have got the time, if you have got the space, and I try and make the space for this, sometimes in the morning, I feel really tired. My body's telling me, go and lay down. But I've just been asleep. I listen to my body. But I said, go lay down. It's okay. And I lay down, and as soon as my head hits the pillow, just put you out for an hour or something. And afterwards, get up, have a shower if you can, cup of tea or a drink of water, whatever, and then meditate. Oh, meditations after that practice are just so powerful. It's like my body's been telling me there's a bug in the system somewhere. Just body says, give me an hour, you get out of the way and just go to sleep, and my body fixes up the problem. And that's actually how I listen to my body. It tells me what to do. Sometimes it says, I need to go for a walk. So I go for a walk. It says, I need some more water, I need some drinks, I need something. So I listen to my body. My body gives me so many answers. You can only do that if you're silent. If you're thinking, arguing, planning, you're not listening to the teachings of this moment, and the body just is teaching you how to be healthy. And it's not the same as you read in books. This is how you feel your body, where it was made, how it's been brought up, and what it needs. And it tells you. So that's where the silence is also great for the health. And in that silence, this is so beautiful. Even that layer of petals of the lotus is so gorgeous. Can you hear the silence? Can you feel it? Can you soak it up in your body? That is why, to practice that meditation, one of the best ways is when it's not too hot. It's really hot in the morning. Surprising hot this time of the day, but anyway, sit on the stupa, get a chair and just have a cup of tea or water outside the dining area, and what I call watch the trees grow. They do grow. Have you ever seen a tree grow? You've got to be very patient and very still. Because if you start doing something, that's when the tree grows. And you miss it. So it's just a little technique of learning how to be silent, to be still. What are you doing? Are you meditating? I said, no, meditating is not something you do. Meditation is what happens when you don't do something. A lot of times, you know, we do so much. Even when we're lazy, we're doing something. But to be able to sit there and just absolutely do nothing, then you find it gets so peaceful, so joyful. You get into that stage of petals, the silence. And of course, after the silence, whoa, what happens next? Surprisingly, what happens after the silence is you do become aware of your breathing. Because there's nothing else happening. Especially when you meditate, you've got your eyes closed, you can't see anything. It's a pretty quiet place in here. People are pretty good, at least when I'm in here. I don't know what you do when I go. Now, everyone here has got this beautiful mind, and they're really trying their very best. So it's great. So they're quiet enough. There's no sound going on. Reasonably healthy, your body's relaxing, you can sit in a chair. So your body shouldn't be that much of a disturbance. The only thing moving now is you're breathing. So that's what you become aware of. You don't go looking for the breathing. You don't go looking for the silence. It's just what happens when you go inside. Mindfulness and kindness, and you go into the inside the body, into this time, inside of time, into the silence. In the middle of the silence is this beautiful quietness, silence. And in the middle of the silence, you become aware of your breath. And if any of you go and look at the suttas, the way the Buddha described it, he said, even before you start watching your breath, being aware of your breath, encourage, make mindfulness your priority first of all. Get your mindfulness strong enough. And that's one of the reasons why people, they start meditating, they go onto their breathing way too soon. And they can't hold their breath, and they think, I can't meditate. They give up and do something else. Some people just keep on trying to watch their breath. And they keep on trying. And they get frustrated after a while. It's not the fact that the meditation doesn't work. You're not doing it right, not following the instructions. Get the mindfulness in the present moment, silence. Then the breath is there for you. It comes to you. When it comes to you, you don't own it. It's not your breath. Remember the anatta. Never look at your breathing as your maid or your servant or your slave. A lot of times people do that. I was told when I started meditating, if your mind wanders off, or in other words, your breath, go out, bring the breath back, bring it back again. So I kept on doing that. mind wandered, breath was unaware. So bring the mind back, the mindfulness back, kept on bringing it back, bringing it back, bringing it back for about 5 or 6 years until you met Ajahn Chah. And he said, well, don't just keep doing these things. Ask, why does your breath disappear? Why does the mindfulness get lost? Why? Cause and effect. And the reason was I was treating my mind like it belonged to me, like a slave. Bad mind. Bad, 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 bad. What happens if you do that? You just get a sore head. So instead, you're kind to your mind. Okay, mind, you want to go off somewhere? Off you go. What is that? Lovely story. This was a girl over here in Perth. She was a young mother. Her 5 or 6 year old kid, boy, one day had an argument with his mummy and did something wrong. And so the kid got so upset and said, okay, mummy, you don't love me anymore. I'm going to leave home. And the mother said, leaving home at your age? What a good idea. I'll help you pack. I know if you've got kids, I mean, you may have thought about that idea and thought, oh, that'd be a good idea, but haven't had the guts to do it. But she had the guts to do it. She went and helped her kid pack the suitcase. All the essentials of life, like the Spider-Man suit and the lucky underpants or whatever. And then she said, oh, before you go, son, you know, life is a long journey, so I have to give you something for lunch. So made her favourite sandwiches, and, you know, put them in a little paper bag and gave it to the son. And she waved her son off at the front door of the house. Bye-bye, son. Have a wonderful life. Don't forget to keep in touch every now and again. Bye. And a true story. The son went with suitcase in one hand, only a small one, and a paper bag with the sandwiches in the other, went to the end of the path, opened the gate, turned left into its life. 5 or 6 year old, leaving home for the first time. Got about maybe 100 yards down the road and was so, so homesick. The kid turned around, went back, opened the garden gate, went down the path. The mother hadn't moved. The mother knew what was going on. And, welcome home, darling. Did you have a wonderful life? That is emotional intelligence. That is how you deal with your mind. If your mind ever looked at me like a 5-year-old kid, you're just totally stupid. If it wants to leave, off you go. When you come back, let me know. If you treat it like that, your mind is realizing you're kind to it. You're not treating it like a slave. You're not trying to control it. You're actually working with it. And then your mind will say, wow, this is a really nice person. I'm going to stay with you. So that's how you hang out together. That's how I hang out with my mind. I don't tell it what to do. Sit down, close my eyes. Hi again, how are you? So if you want to go off somewhere, please do. If you want to stay, fine. And then when I treat it like that, of course, my mind likes hanging out with me. So I sit here for hours sometimes, just hanging out together. Breathing in, breathing out. But I never treat it like I own it. I'm a visitor, not an owner. That's non-self, not mine. And that way that you can have a wonderful time together. And you see your breath, and your breath becomes so beautiful, so gorgeous, because you're soft. And this is another part of the teaching. I promise I will stop in a moment. It's already 9 o'clock. So what happens next is that the breath comes up and it's very beautiful. The reason it's beautiful, it's not nothing to do with your breathing. Your mind is energized. When it's energized, whatever you see is gorgeous, it's wonderful. You know that sometimes people tell me they get up in the morning and they're just a pain in the neck until they've had their first cup of coffee. Maybe 2 cups of coffee, some people. And then they're human. In other words, they're kind. So instead of having cups of coffee or tea, just meditate and just let go, and then it becomes so energized. Whatever you look at, it's beautiful. Your mindfulness gets empowered. Mindfulness is not something static. It gets stronger and stronger. My goodness, it really gets powerful sometimes. You get so much joy. So whatever you look at. So the mindfulness goes up, you can see the breath becomes really beautiful. Watch the breath going in. Oh, it's just like some symphony you're watching. And every breath is different. You'll never ever breathe two breaths which are the same in your whole life. If you can see them properly. Yes, I know, we're in, out, in, out. That's not seeing the breath, that's just seeing a tiny bit of it. Just like saying girl, boy, boy, girl, monk, nun. That's not who we are. It's much deeper than that. Much more. So you see the whole breath. Wow. Incredible. It's delightful. You see, you don't have to force yourself to see. It's fascinating watching your breath. So much going on there. Enjoying the beautiful peace, just watching the breath go in, breath go out. Just like sitting by the beach, watching the waves come in, the waves go out. No two waves are the same. So you can see different things in each. Delightful. And then you get more and more peaceful. The joy gets stronger. It's these beautiful lights we call the nimittas. What do you do with those lights? These are, please don't make this mistake. I don't know why people just don't follow the instructions. Say, oh, I've got nimittas now. Now I can mess around with them this way, that way. My nimittas, they sometimes call it. It's not your nimittas. It's just these lights come up in the mind. Just carry on, just being kind, being aware. Just so you don't own these things, leave them alone. And then they get very bright. Beautiful. Nice thing about nimittas, if you do mess around with them, they disappear. If you do leave them alone, you open the door of your heart to them. No matter what they are, how they exist, what they do, the door of my heart's open to you, nimitta. Total acceptance and kindness. And then that mindfulness and kindness, just the nimittas get stronger and stronger. You go deeply into them, and then you get into these jhanas. And first jhana, second jhana is inside the first, the third is inside the second. You just go in. And when you get to those states, those are incredibly powerful, beautiful petals of your lotus. You're finding out what's really inside of you. Whoa! You never expected that. Isn't that a wonderful gift for yourself? See what's inside. And it's not the next stage. Stay where you are and go deeper inside of it. It's going inwards, not onwards. That's why I really don't like stages. Stage one, okay, I've done stage one. Now I can, this, today I'm going to do stage two. Okay, have I completed stage two, Ajahn Brahm? Okay, Ajahn Brahm says I've completed stage two, now I'm going to go to stage three. It doesn't work like that. Stay where you are. Go inside of it. Where you are right now. Go inside of that. Where you reach next, go inside of it. Keep just going in. Zooming in to your center and see what's there. That's part one of the Thousand Petal Lotus. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thanks very much. Very good.